The Bob Dempster who showed up at the meeting held at Joel Montgomery's bank did not look like the Dempster everyone thought they knew. Dempster had taken a bath, gotten a haircut and shave, and was wearing a very nice suit. He arrived at the meeting with Marshal Kyle, Mrs. Dawkins, and her son Timmy.
It's good of you to come, Mr. Dempster.
I thank you very much for allowing me to come. I'm well aware of the fact that I've not conducted myself in any way that would inspire confidence.
I believe everyone deserves a second chance. Marshal, Mrs. Dawkins, Timmy, it's good to have you as well. Please, come into the conference room and have a seat. The meeting's just about to get started.
Dempster, Kyle, Mrs. Dawkins, and Timmy followed Montgomery to the back of the bank, where Montgomery opened a door to show them into the back room.
Do you think it will be safe here?
We've got the marshal with us. How much safer do you want it?
The marshal isn't always going to be here. And after he leaves, Marshal Cummins will still be here.
It's safe. We've had several meetings here without any problem. I often have to work late, so people are used to seeing a light in here. Besides, at this time of night, the marshal and his deputies are over at the Paradise, drinking.
That's not all they're doing over there.
Anion, we have a woman and child with us.
Sorry, ma'am. Didn't mean nothing by it.
I've taken no offense, Mr. Goff. I want to do what is best for the town, but I'm sure you can understand that my primary concern is for the safety of my own son.
Well, yes, ma'am, that's our concern as well. And on behalf of the Citizens Betterment Committee, I want to thank you and your son and tell you that we understand the danger and appreciate your courage in coming to the meeting.
Citizens Betterment Committee. I like that.
All right, if everyone will take their seats, we'll get started now.
Goff, Goodman, Taylor, and Bascom, who were, in addition to Montgomery, members of the Citizens Betterment Committee, took their seats around the table. Dempster, Kyle, Mrs. Dawkins, and Timmy joined them.
Timmy, my wife made some cookies if you'd like one.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Timmy took three of them.
Timmy, he said one.
That's all right, Mrs. Dawkins. He can have as many as he wants. Although you are right. Too many wouldn't be good for him.
Timmy put two of the cookies back.
Gentlemen, I called this meeting after Marshal Kyle and Mr. Dempster came to visit me. As you know, Marshal Cummins recently conducted a court trial, if you can call it that, in which he found a man guilty and sentenced him to hang. In order to give some semblance of legality to it, he had the man sent to Yuma Prison, where the hanging was to be carried out. As you also know, Robert Dempster acted as defense counsel for the accused. He came to me with an interesting account of that trial, and I invited him to share the information with the rest of us. Mr. Dempster, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Mr. Montgomery is correct when he says I acted as defense counsel for the accused. In this case, acted is the operative word, for the truth is, I was far too drunk to provide an adequate defense for anyone. Marshal Cummins knew this and counted upon this when he selected me as attorney for the defense. I'm not going to go through a litany of all the errors in this trial that could cause a reversal of the outcome, though they are legion. I will tell you, however, that any fair judge would at least call this a mistrial, and in all probability completely reverse the decision and declare Matt Jensen innocent.
Mr. Dempster, may I ask a question?
Certainly, Mr. Goff.
I know that you, being a lawyer and all, are probably concerned about all the technical things of the trial, whether he got a good defense, whether the trial was held too fast, that sort of thing. But shouldn't the bottom line be whether or not he's guilty? I mean, if he killed Mo Gillis in cold blood, then that's murder, and it seems to me like it shouldn't make all that difference how the trial was conducted. Now, the man committed murder, and he should pay for it.
That's just it. I don't think the man did commit murder.
How can you say that? My brother-in-law was in the saloon that day, and he tells me that he saw Gillis come staggering in through the door, already gunshot, with his pistol in his holster. Then a second or two later, this fellow Jensen come in behind him, holding a gun in his hand. And that gun, my brother-in-law says, was still smoking.
There was only one eyewitness to the actual event, and he tells a different story.
What about Jackson? I hear Jackson was standing in front of the saloon and he seen the whole thing.
Jackson didn't see it.
He claims that he did.
Gentlemen, I was present when I heard Marshal Cummins order Jackson to make that claim.
Wait a minute, hold it. Are you saying that the marshal told Jackson to lie?
Oh, my. Who could possibly believe that our marshal would ask someone to lie for him? You said there was an eyewitness.
Yes.
Who was it?
It was young Timmy Dawkins.
A kid? You're saying the only eyewitness was a kid?
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, come on. Who's going to believe a kid? And how did he happen to say it in the first place?
Timmy, you want to answer that?
I was in the dress shop with Mama. It's right across the street from where it happened. I was looking through the window, and I saw it all.
All right. Maybe the kid did see it. But like Goff said, who's going to believe a kid? Even if Timmy thinks he is telling the truth, kids don't always see things the way they actually are.
Timmy happens to be a remarkably observant young man.
Observant? What do you mean, remarkably observant?
Test him.
What do you mean, test him?
Ask him something to test his observation skills.
All right. Timmy, there is a calendar in this room without looking at it. Tell me about the picture.
Well, it's a picture of a train at night. The train's headlight is on, and some of the car windows are lit, but not all of them. And there's a coyote on a cliff looking down at the train.
Yes, that's very good.
Timmy, am I wearing a ring?
Well, no, sir, you aren't. But Mr. Montgomery is. It has a red stone.
Montgomery's hands were under the table, and with a smile, he raised them to show a ring with a red stone.
All right. Well, I think we can all agree that Timmy is a very observant and very bright young man.
Good. Timmy, tell us exactly what you saw on the day of the shooting.
Well, I saw Mr. Jensen come riding into town. Of course, I didn't know who he was then, but I saw that he was riding a very pretty sorrel horse. He got off the horse, hung a wet hat onto the saddle.
Oh, wait a minute. A wet hat? How could his hat be wet? It wasn't raining that day.
I wondered about that as well. But it turns out that as Jensen rode into town, he stopped by Mrs. Poindexter's place. She was pumping water into a bucket. He finished filling the bucket for her. Then he pumped water into his hat and gave it to his horse.
I'll be damned. And it checks out. Beg pardon for the cuss word, Mrs. Dawkins.
That's quite all right.
Go on with your account, Timmy.
Yes, sir. Well, after he hung the wet hat on the saddle, he tied his horse to the hitching rail in front of the saloon. Then Deputy Gillis stepped out onto the front porch. They talked for a moment, but I couldn't hear what they were talking about. Then Deputy Gillis reached for his gun. Mr. Jensen went for his gun, too, and he drew his faster than Deputy Gillis. He shot Deputy Gillis, and the deputy dropped his pistol back into his holster, then turned and walked back into the saloon. Mr. Jensen followed him into the saloon, and that was all I saw.
Thank you, Timmy. You may be interested to know that this is the very same story Jensen told during that debacle of a trial.
All right, suppose this is true. At this point, what can we do about it?
We can remove the marshal.
How?
If you will back me up with a bill of particulars, I will go to the governor's office.
Will the governor listen to us?
I think he will. Mr. Dempster has started the ball rolling with a letter he sent to the governor, and I'll follow up on it.
You can count on us, Marshal.
Kyle sat in the governor's outer office. He was holding his white hat in his lap, and he glanced down toward his boots, which gleamed in a high gloss, polished just for this occasion. At the back of the room was a door, and in the transom window over the door were the words, Governor's Office. The door opened, and Kyle was led into the room. John C. Fremont was standing with his back to the door, studying a map that was hung on the wall. The map was very large and included all the states and territories west of the Mississippi River. It appeared that Fremont had not seen Kyle.
Why does everyone clear their throat to announce their presence? Why not just call out, hey, you?
Hey, you.
So, Marshal, you are here to talk about the town of Purgatory.
Yes, sir.
Do you know the town?
I just came from Purgatory.
That's not what I asked. I asked if you know the town.
I think I do. It was more than just a casual visit. I met with some of the town's most influential people.
Robert Dempster?
Yes, sir. I met with Dempster.
He's a drunk, isn't he?
Do you know Mr. Dempster?
I know him by reputation only. From what I understand, he was once a very fine jurist.
Yes, sir. That is my understanding as well.
And now he is a drunk.
I think it might be better to say that now he is a reformed drunk. When I met with him, he was sober, and he stayed sober for the entire time I was there.
I see. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
The governor stroked his chin, then picked something up from his desk.
He wrote me a letter, you know.
Yes, sir, so he said.
It was about the trial of Matt Jensen.
Yes, sir.
What do you know about the trial?
Only what I learned while I was there. And from what I've learned, the trial was gross miscarriage of justice. In fact, the word justice can hardly be applied. Cummins was both the arresting officer and, in the case of the trial, the judge. And the shooting, trial, and conviction all happened within less than an hour. I don't see how a trial like that could possibly be fair. The only thing that kept it from being a lynching was the fact that they were sending Jensen to Yuma to be hanged.
Do you think Jensen killed Deputy Gillis?
Oh, there's no question that he did. But I also heard from an eyewitness who testified that he saw the deputy draw first.
Do you believe the witness?
Yes, Governor, I do believe him. On top of that, from everything I have been able to find out about Matt Jensen, there is nothing that would make me think he could kill a man in cold blood.
Do you know Matt Jensen?
Well, not exactly. I met him at the train wreck, though I didn't know at the time who he was. He was working to pull people from the wreckage, and he helped Doc Presnell attend to the injured. And also, it seems anyone who ran into him has nothing but praise for the man.
Let me tell you what I know about Matt Jensen.
Well, you know him?
No, but Governor John Rout of Colorado does. I checked with neighboring states, and this is what I got back from Governor Rout.
Fremont began reading from a sheet of paper.
Last winter, during an attempted train robbery, some bandits killed both the engineer and the fireman of the Midnight Flyer. Now, the dead man's throttle is supposed to stop the train anytime the engineer is incapacitated, but it failed. And rather than stopping the train as the bandits planned, their actions caused a runaway train. Matt Jensen was a passenger on that train, and while he knew nothing about the attempted holdup, he did realize rather quickly that the train was in great danger. He knew also that somehow he would have to get to the engine. The only way for him to get to the engine was to crawl along the top of the swaying, ice-covered cars on a train that was speeding through the dark at 60 miles per hour. Matt finally managed to reach the engine and stop the train just before it rounded a sharp turn. Had he not succeeded, the speed they were traveling would have sent the train and all 131 passengers over the side of a mountain to certain death. As governor of the state of Colorado, I issued a proclamation declaring a day to be officially entered into the state historical records as Matthew Jensen Day.
Fremont put the paper down.
Does that sound like someone who would kill in cold blood?
No, sir, it does not. That's more like the person I saw at the site of the train wreck.
But Marshal Cummins believes him to be a murderer.
He either believes it or has reason to want others to believe it.
Does Marshal Cummins have everything under control?
Yes. If you call having the entire town under his thumb as being under control.
Under his thumb?
Governor, Marshal Cummins has 6 deputies to help him keep control.
Isn't that a little excessive?
Excessive? Yes, and much more than a little excessive. If I had my way, that town would be cleaned up and Cummins would be gone.
You do have your way.
I beg your pardon?
I am overturning the results of the trial. I am granting Matt Jensen a full and complete pardon. It would probably be better to have a new trial so he could be completely absolved. But in the meantime, the pardon will have to do. I also have something else I want you to look into.
And what is that?
Governor Fremont picked up a letter from his desk.
This is a letter from a man named Ronald Jerome. He was my adjutant during the war, and he is a longtime friend. It seems his son disappeared in Purgatory.
Disappeared?
Yes. Apparently, Jerome brought some property near Purgatory, and his son, Cornelius, came out here to take possession of it. And while Cornelius posted a letter to his father every day of the trip, he did not do so on the day he was to have arrived in Purgatory. Would you look into that for me?
Well, yes, sir, I will.
Based upon what you have just told me, and based upon the letter I received from Robert Dempster, I am now convinced that this man Cummins has no right to occupy the office of city marshal. Unfortunately, I have no authority to relieve him unless we can find him guilty of a felony. I'm going to give you that responsibility.
That is quite a responsibility.
I know that you can handle it. But first, I want you to find this man, Matt Jensen, and inform him that he is no longer wanted for the murder of this man, Mo Gillis. I don't want that hanging over his head much longer. When someone is wanted for murder, they are sometimes pressed into doing things they would not otherwise do. I think it is important that we notify him as quickly as we can.
I agree. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that, but I agree with you that it does need to be done.
When Paco Bustamante rode into Culik, he saw a small group of people standing in front of the hardware store. At first, he didn't know what they were looking at, but then he saw a coffin standing upright. Riding over toward it, he was startled to see that the coffin was occupied by a body. The body was that of Emerson Bates. There was a sign above the coffin.
"This corpse was prepared by Ebenezer Cartwright. See me for all your undertaking needs."
I think it is disgusting to put a body on display like that just to advertise your work.
"Well, from what I heard, his throat was cut and he looked pretty bad. I reckon old Cartwright is some pleased with his work. Besides which, didn't nobody know where Bates come from, so it ain't like he's going to have kin to complain. The only friend he had rode out of town butt naked."
Paco hung back as the man in the group told and retold with great relish the story of Cletus Odom leaping through a window on the second floor, then, without a stitch of clothes, riding out of town.
"I never thought of Odom as being someone who would run from anyone. Who was he running from?"
"He was running from the same person who killed Bates. His name was Cavanaugh."
"Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about. Fact of it is, Cavanaugh is still in town, staying over to the Homestead Hotel. He's been asking a lot of questions. He's trying to find the ones who wrecked that train a couple of weeks ago. I think he's a lawman or something."
"He says he ain't no lawman. He says he just wants revenge against the ones who wrecked the train and killed all those people."
"Revenge, huh?"
"Yeah, revenge. Leastwise, that's what he says."
"Revenge. Damn. I'll tell you the truth then. I don't think I'd want to be one of the people he's after then. When it is the law that's after you, you can figure the most likely what will happen to you is you'll get a trial and maybe go to jail. Even if you get hung, it'll take a while for them to appeal and all that. But when someone is after revenge, and they don't stop until they find you. And most likely when they find you, the only thing in their mind is killing you. You ask me, Odom is making a big mistake by running."
"What do you mean he's making a big mistake? Didn't you just say that the only thing a man out for revenge wants to do is kill you?"
"Yes, and the only way you're going to stop him is to kill him first."
"Damn! Remind me never to piss someone off so much that he wants revenge."
"How does this fella, Cavanaugh, is it? How does he know who he's looking for?"
"Turns out he was on the train that was robbed and he saw the outlaws. Not only that, he even knows every one of them by name. According to him, Bates was one of the train robbers. Cletus Odom was another, along with a fellow named Schuler. He also says there was a Mexican by the name of Paco."
"Paco?" "The fourth train robber was a Mexican by the name of Paco? Well, that should narrow it down to about 1,000 Mexicans."
Paco rode back out of town. He had planned to meet Odom and Bates here, but with Bates dead and Odom running, there was no reason for him to remain. Paco's first thought was to just keep riding, but he stopped and thought about what the man back in town had said about revenge. They never give up until they find the ones they're looking for. And in this case, Cavanaugh knew them by name. Paco had no choice. He had to kill Cavanaugh before Cavanaugh killed him. He dismounted, found a spot of shade, and waited for nightfall. Matt had no idea what awakened him. It may have been a type of kinesthetic reflex born from years of living on the edge. The bullet slammed into the headboard of the bed where, but a second earlier, Matt had been sleeping. At the same time Matt rolled off the bed, he grabbed the pistol from under his pillow. Now the advantage was his. Matt stepped out into the hallway of the hotel, then looked down at the man he had just killed. The body was illuminated by the soft glow of a wall-mounted kerosene lantern. It was the same Mexican he had seen on the train during the robbery.
"You again? You've already killed one man in this town. How many are you planning on killing? Who is this man?"
"His name is Paco."
"Why did you kill him?"
"Because he was trying to kill me. and that seemed like the practical thing to do.
Why was he trying to kill you?
Because he knew I was going to kill him if I found him.
Mister, that don't make any sense at all.
It does to me.
What are you going to do about him now?
Nothing. I don't need to do anything about him now. He's dead.
Well, good Lord, man. You don't plan to just leave him laying out here in the hall, do you?
If you want him out of here, take him out of here.
The hell you say? I didn't kill him.
All right.
Leaning down, Matt picked Paco up and threw his body over his shoulder.
Now you are being sensible.
Without another word, Matt walked to the rear end of the hall where he raised the window that opened out onto the alley.
Hey! What are you doing?
That done, he lowered the window. Then, brushing his hands as if having just completed an onerous task, he returned to his own room.
That should take care of it. Sleep well, everyone.
Matt was eating breakfast at the Chulik Cafe when a woman came in. Looking around for a moment, she saw Matt and came directly to his table.
Mr. Cavanaugh.
This was the same soiled dove that had been in bed with Bates when Matt and Bates had had their encounter. By now, Matt had been in town long enough and had spent enough time in the saloon to know her by name. Matt stood up.
Hello, Jenny.
Oh, my, you don't have to stand for me.
You are a woman. I treat all women with courtesy.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Have you had your breakfast?
I'm not much of a breakfast person.
You could join me for coffee, couldn't you?
I don't know. Mr. Appleby doesn't like for people like me, women who are on the line, to come in here.
Nonsense. You are my guest.
Matt held a chair out for Jenny, then moved around the table to retake his own seat. He was fully aware of some of the glances he was receiving from many of the other diners, but he paid no attention to them.
What brings you to my table, Jenny? Although I'm enjoying the company, I have the feeling that you didn't stop by just to be sociable.
I hear that you're looking for Moses Schuler.
Yes, do you know him?
Yes, I know him. I know him very well. Moses killed my husband.
Your husband?
Yes, Mr. Cavanaugh, my husband. I wasn't born a whore.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that you were.
I know. I guess when I think about it, I'm just a little sensitive. Carl and I had been married for a little over a year. His parents didn't approve of the marriage. After all, Carl was an educated man, a mining engineer, and he met me when I was working as a maid for his family. But Carl didn't care what they thought. He loved me, and I loved him, so we were married, and we left Louisville to come out west. Carl had taken a position with the Cross Point Mine.
Oh, I see. Earlier, when you said Schuler killed your husband, you were talking about the cave-in at the Cross Point Mine, weren't you? The one Schuler caused?
Yes. You know about that?
I've heard about it.
Was an accident. I don't really blame Moses, but he blames himself. That's why he turned into an alcoholic.
Did you know Schuler before the accident?
I knew him very well. I told you that Carl's family was opposed to our getting married, but that's only true about his mother and father. His brother was very supportive, something that Carl and I both appreciated.
His brother?
Yes, Mr. Cavanaugh. Moses Schuler was Carl Schuler's brother. My brother-in-law.
I see.
No, I'm not sure you do see. I do want to help you find him because I believe he is on the path to self-destruction and needs to be stopped. But before I tell you where to look, I need to ask you what you are going to do with him when you do find him.
If you're worried about that, don't tell me where he is. Because whatever I do will be between him and me. I don't want you saddled with any kind of guilty conscience.
I have to know, Mr. Cavanaugh, was he one of the people who robbed the train?
Yes.
You aren't the law, and you aren't a bounty hunter. Why are you after these men?
Because of Susie Dobbs.
Susie Dobbs? Was she killed in the train wreck?
Yes.
Who was she? Your wife? Your fiancé? Your girlfriend?
No. She was a little 4-year-old girl.
Matt described how he had pulled her from the wreck, dead, with a stake driven through her heart.
Oh. Oh, that's awful.
I then made a vow to myself to find justice for her.
I tell you the truth, Mr. Cavanaugh, I know that Moses has done some things he shouldn't have done since he started drinking, and I'm sure some of it is against the law. Moses is no angel, that's for sure, but I cannot believe that he would have anything to do with killing that little girl.
Matt remembered Schuler's reaction when the train robbers were in the express car. He alone had expressed some remorse and concern over what they had done.
Of course, I haven't seen Moses in quite a while. it could be that him being a drunk and all, that he might... Well, I suppose if he needed a drink bad enough, you could talk him into about anything.
Do you know where he is?
Jenny was quiet for a long moment, as if struggling with her soul.
Jenny, he alone expressed surprise and remorse at the outcome of the train wreck. I won't kill him unless he tries to kill me. Right now, the one I am really after is Cletus Odom. I'm just hoping that Schuler can help me find him.
You might try Quigatoa.
Quigatoa?
It's a small town just a little north of here. That's where Moses hangs out most of the time.
Does he live there?
Does he live there? I suppose you could say that he lives there, but a more accurate answer would be to say that the only reason he is there is because the folks in Quigatoa are willing to put up with him.
It was now 2 weeks since Dempster had had drink, and though it was still hard to abstain, it seemed to him to be getting a little easier. The cravings still occurred, but they were more isolated and did not occupy every waking moment as they once had. He was also taking more pride in his personal appearance, and had just taken a bath, shaved, and put on another clean suit, shirt, and tie. Now, it was time for another haircut. So he walked down the street to Tony's Tonsorial Treatments. Nobody recognized him when he stepped into the barber shop.
Yes, sir, friend. You need a haircut?
The barber had one customer in his chair, and there were two more waiting.
There are two more ahead of you, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all, Tony.
Although nobody had recognized Dempster on sight, they all recognized his voice.
Dempster? Is that you?
In the flesh.
It is you. Who would have thought?
Dempster took off his hat and hung it on the rack. As he did so, he happened to glance through the window, and that was when he saw Cletus Odom riding into town.
I'll be damned. What's he doing here?
Who? What are you talking about?
Cletus Odom. I just saw him ride by as big and bold as you please.
Cletus Odom? Are you sure?
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, how do you know it's him?
I know it's him. Because I once had the dubious distinction of defending him against a charge of murder. Back in the days when he was still a bounty hunter. Tony, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to put off getting that haircut until later.
Yeah, anytime, Mr. Dempster. Anytime.
Leaving the barber shop, Dempster hurried down the street to the bank. When he went into the bank, he caused the same initial reaction he had in the barber shop. People were startled when they recognized him. He walked quickly to the desk of Joel Montgomery, the owner of the bank.
Mr. Dempster, what a pleasant surprise.
Mr. Montgomery, may I speak to you alone for a moment?
Well, yes, I suppose. What is this about?
Possible trouble.
Montgomery led the way to the conference room, then closed the door behind them.
What is it?
I just saw Cletus Odom ride into town.
The outlaw? Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Oh, my, oh, my. If he is in this town, it can only be for one reason. He's planning to rob the bank.
I think you might be right. Only we know he's here, so that gives us a little advantage.
So what do we do now?
We're paying a heavy tax to the marshal and his deputies, aren't we?
Yes.
Then it's time that Cummins started earning his money.
Yes, you're right. I never thought I would hear myself say this, but I'm glad Cummins has all those deputies. Surely they can handle Cletus Odom.
One would certainly think so, wouldn't one?
So what do we do now?
Now? Now we go to Marshal Cummins, inform him of the presence of a wanted outlaw, and demand that he do his duty.
Who?
Who what?
Who is going to see Cummins and demand action?
I'll do it.
Cummins and two of his deputies were in the marshal's office when Dempster stepped inside.
Excuse me.
The three men looked over toward him.
Well, now, look what the cat drug in.
Oh, Dempster, it's good of you to drop by.
Cummins opened the top drawer of his desk and pulled out a bottle of whiskey, filled a glass, then slid the glass across the desk toward Dempster.
Have a drink.
Thank you, no.
No?
Bo, did you just hear Mr. Dempster say no?
I never thought that old drunk would turn a drink down.
Maybe he thinks he's too good to drink with us.
No, it isn't that. I'm sure you understand. I'm an alcoholic. I'm trying to quit drinking.
You're trying to quit drinking? Boys, have you ever known a drunk who gave up?
I ain't never known one.
Me neither.
No, and you ain't never going to know one because it can't be done.
Jackson looked at Dempster again.
So why are you trying to fight it? You know you want a drink, and here it is, just waiting for you. and it's being offered in friendship.
Well, maybe he don't want to be our friend. He has been meeting with Montgomery and them other troublemakers.
How do you know that?
Well, now, Mr. Dempster, you act a little surprised.
Dempster didn't answer.
You don't think folks can hold a meeting in this town without me knowing about it, do you? See, this here is purgatory, Mr. Dempster. And I own purgatory. See, nothing happens in purgatory without my knowledge or permission.
You are the marshal, not the king.
The marshal, not the king. Huh. That sounds like a political slogan. Are you considering running for some office, Mr. Dempster?
In fact, though he had told no one, Dempster had considered running for circuit judge.
If I run for anything, you'll know it, Marshal Cummins. Believe me, you'll know it.
Well, now, that sounds like a threat. Are you threatening me, Counselor?
A quick spasm of fear overtook Dempster, and the hackles rose on the back of his neck. The conversation had gone beyond mere banter, and he needed to change the tone.
No, no. I'm not making any threat. I just meant that if I ever did run for office, why everyone would know about it. Or they'd have to know about it. Otherwise, who'd vote for me?
I can answer that question for you. Nobody would vote for you because nobody's going to vote for a drunk.
What do you want, Dempster?
I just saw Cletus Odom coming into town.
Oh, Cletus Odom, you say? And you saw him coming into town?
Yes. He was riding right down the middle of Central Street, just as big and bold as you please.
Mr. Dempster, why did you feel you had to come and tell me about Cletus Odom?
Because you're the marshal.
And?
And because Cletus Odom is a wanted outlaw.
Not in purgatory, he isn't.
Course he is. He's wanted all over the Arizona Territory.
And you once defended him. What kind of a lawyer are you, Dempster, that you would turn on a man you once defended?
Dempster had never told anyone that he had once defended Odom until he shared that information with Montgomery just a few minutes earlier.
How did you know I once defended him?
Because Cletus told me you did.
Odom told you? I don't understand. When did you and Odom ever have a conversation? And why would he have told you that?
Because brothers, we share things.
Brothers? You and Cletus Odom are brothers?
Half brothers. Cletus, get on out here. I want you to meet an old friend of yours.
A door at the back of the room opened and Cletus Odom stepped out. Dempster noticed in shock that Odom was wearing a star pinned to his vest.
Mr. Dempster, meet my newest deputy.
It started raining about an hour before Matt reached Quigatoa. Although rainfall was scarce in the desert, when it did rain, it was often a torrential downpour. This was just such a rain, and Matt had to be careful to avoid dry creek beds, arroyos, and low-lying areas for fear of a sudden flash flood. Matt put on a rain slicker and hunkered down in the saddle, but nothing helped.
Just a little farther, Spirit. I'll find a place to get you dry, I promise.
Finally, cresting a ridge, Matt saw the town of Quigatoa in the distance, low-lying and gray against the diaphanous curtain of the rainstorm.
There it is, boy. Told you wouldn't be much farther.
It took another 15 minutes or so after the little town was spotted before Matt reached it. The street was a slurry of mud mixed with horse apples. The droppings reconstituted by the water, so the stench rose in the air. He saw a stable that was no more than a roof over a pen. It wasn't exactly a livery, but it would provide Spirit with some shelter from the rain and from the sun after the rain passed. He rode up to it, then dismounted. At first, he didn't see anyone. Then, at second glance, he saw someone sitting in one corner of the stable where, in addition to the roof, there were half walls, thus providing a bit more shelter from the rain.
Is this a public livery?
It's easy, York. 10 cents, one night.
Here's 50 cents. Give him something to eat and take care of my saddle.
The prospect of 50 cents was enough to bring the old Mexican away from the shelter, and he had a big smile on his face as he approached.
Gracias, señor. You daré muy bien de su trabajo.
Hear that, Spirit? You can take very good care of him.
Reaching the boardwalk on the other side of the street, he walked down to the Casa del Sol Cantina. Inside the cantina, a long board of wooden pegs was nailed along one wall about 6 feet from the floor. Matt hung his slicker on one of the pegs to let it drip dry. A careful scrutiny of the saloon disclosed a card game in progress near the back. At one of the front tables, there was some earnest conversation. Three men stood at the bar, each complete within themselves, concentrating only on their drinks and private thoughts. A soiled dove near the end of her professional effectiveness, overweight with bad teeth and wild unkempt hair, stood at the far end. She smiled at Matt, but getting no encouragement, she stayed put.
Where'll it be, mister?
The bartender was making a swipe across the bar with a sour-smelling cloth.
Beer.
When the beer was served, Matt picked it up, then turned his back to the bar for a more leisurely survey of the room. Ascertaining that there was nothing here that represented an immediate threat, he turned back to the bartender.
I'm looking for Moses Schuler. I'm told I might find him here.
Why do you want Schuler?
That's between Schuler and me.
You the law?
Schuler.
We don't care much for the law around here.
Suddenly, Matt reached his left hand across the bar and grabbed the collar of the bartender's shirt.
Mister, I've ridden half a day in a driving rainstorm. I'm in no mood for games. I'm gonna ask you one more time where I can find Schuler. If you don't answer me, I'm gonna break your neck, then find someone who will answer me.
To illustrate his point, Matt twisted the collar even tighter.
I'll see if I can find him.
I appreciate that.
One!
A Mexican boy and his teen stepped out of the back room. He was wearing an apron and holding a broom.
Si, senor.
You see Schuler around?
Si, senor. He's sleeping in the back room.
Get him out here. There's someone who wants to talk to him.
I will try, senor. Maybe I cannot wake him up. He is sleeping very hard.
Sleeping or passed out?
I think maybe he is passed out.
The bartender poured a drink into a glass, then slid it down the bar toward Juan.
Give him this. Tell him there's someone out here that wants to buy him another drink. That'll bring him out.
The bartender looked at Matt.
You will buy him a drink, won't you?
Yes. Give me a bottle.
The bartender handed Matt a bottle. Matt took it, looked over at Juan, then pointed to an empty table.
I'll be over there, Juan. Bring him to me.
Si.
Juan disappeared into the back room. After a long pause, a bent, white-haired man came out of the room. At first, Matt was about to say this wasn't the one he was looking for. This man looked nothing like the robber he had seen in the express car. But as he studied him more closely, he saw that this was indeed the same man. Dispirited, but the same man.
Someone's gonna buy me a drink?
That man over there, senor.
Juan pointed to the table where Matt was sitting, and Schuler shuffled over toward him, unabashedly scratching his crotch as he did so. Matt had rarely seen a man who had come down as far as Schuler had since the last time he saw him. Schuler needed a shave, and his clothes reeked of stale whiskey and sour vomit. How could this be? Didn't Schuler get his share from the robbery? Schuler pointed at Matt with a shaking finger.
Do I know you? Who are you?
I am a friend of Jenny Schuler.
Anyone who has money is a friend of Jenny Schuler. She is a whore.
I am also the man that's going to buy you a drink.
What do I have to do for it?
Just give me a little information, that's all.
Information? I don't know anything about anything.
Oh, you know something about what I want.
Matt reached out to pick up the glass.
Wait. What do you want to know?
First, let me ask you something. With all the money you got from the train robbery, why are you having to beg for drinks now? Have you already spent it all?
I don't have any money. Paco cheated me out of it. What money?
The money you got cheated out of. That is what you're about to say, isn't it? That Paco cheated you out of your share of the money from the train robbery?
What train robbery? I don't know anything about any train robbery.
Don't lie to me, Schuler. I don't like being lied to. I know you took part in a train robbery because I was there. I was on the train when it wrecked.
That doesn't mean anything.
Oh, but it does. It means that you, Odom, Paco, and Bates are guilty of murder.
I didn't murder anyone.
If you're talking about the deputy, I know you didn't shoot him. I know that he was shot by Cletus Odom.
How do you know that?
I told you, I was there. I saw it. I was in the express car when you and the others came in. I saw everything, Schuler. I'm talking about all the people who were killed when you and the others wrecked the train. I'm talking about a little 4-year-old girl who was traveling with her mother and her brother. Do you know what happened to that little girl?
I ain't got any of the money. Like I said, Paco stole it.
I don't care about the money.
You don't care about the money?
No.
What do you want?
I want Odom.
There are three others.
No, there's only one other.
You're forgetting Paco and Bates.
I'm not forgetting them. They're dead.
Dead?
I killed them both. Where is Odom?
I don't know.
You're lying. What are you afraid of, Shuler?
Nothing. I don't know where he is, that's all.
You do know, don't you, Shuler? Don't be afraid. I'm here.
You're here? Oh, so you're going to protect me if he comes for me? There's not one man in 10 who wouldn't pee in his pants if he comes face to face with Cletus Odom.
You think that's what I would do, Shuler? You think I'd pee in my pants?
I don't know. Who are you?
Doesn't matter who I am. You know where he is, don't you?
What if I do?
Tell me where to find him.
I can.
Forget about the glass. I'll give you the whole bottle.
Not for a bottle. Not even for a case of whiskey will I tell. What good is whiskey to a dead man?
Shuler, I want you to think about something.
Think about what?
You are afraid of the wrong man. Odom isn't here.
Well, that doesn't matter. If I tell you how to find him, and he'll find me.
I've already found you.
What?
Think about it. I found Bates, and I killed him. I found Paco, I killed him. When I find Odom, I will kill him. And like I said, I found you.
I'm afraid.
You should be afraid.
Shuler's bottom lip began trembling, and a line of spittle ran down his chin.
Now, I'm going to ask you again, Shuler, and I want you to think about it. And while you're thinking, I want you to know that I'm here and Odom isn't. Tell me what you know, or I will kill you where you sit.
All right. I was with them, just like you said, but I didn't know they was going to be a lot of people killed. I wouldn't have had nothing to do with it if I'd have known there was going to be a lot of innocent people killed.
I know. I was there in the express car, remember? I heard you tell Odom that you didn't know that he planned to kill anyone. In fact, if I hadn't heard you talking to Odom, I would have killed you by now.
Well, just so as you know.
Where can I find him?
Why are you looking for him? Why are you doing this? You ain't the law, are you?
No. This is personal. One of the people killed was a little girl, about 4 years old. One minute she was riding on the train with her mother and brother, and the next minute the train wrecked and a large stake was driven through her heart.
Oh, no! I didn't know about the little girl. I didn't know about any of them.
Where is Odom?
You got any money?
Why?
If I give you any information, I'm gonna need enough money to get out of here. My life won't be worth a plugged nickel if Odom finds out I told you where to find him.
How can I find him?
It's gonna cost you $50.
Matt pulled $50 from his pocket and handed it over.
All right, here's your money. Now, start talking.
Do you know Odom? I mean, do you really know him?
No.
Well, he's real crazy. I've never known anyone before who likes killing, but Odom actually likes it. Oh, they say he killed his first man when he was 15. There's been others that killed for the first time when they was only 15, but the man Odom killed was his own pa.
Where will I find him?
Did you hear what I said? The first man he killed was his own pa.
I heard.
You find him in purgatory.
What makes you think he's gone to purgatory?
Marshall there is a fella by the name of Cummins. Him and Odom is brothers.
Brothers?
They don't have the same name because they got different papas, but they got the same mama. And after Odom killed his own pa, he moved in with his mama, Cummins, and Cummins' papa.
Thank you.
Don't be thanking me. If you are going to purgatory after Odom, you're going to have to deal with Cummins and all his deputies. And you might find you've bitten off more than you can chew.
I'll take my chances. I'm going.
To face all of them?
Yes.
That's bold talk, Matt Jensen.
Turning slowly, Matt saw a big man with gray hair and a sweeping mustache leaning against the wall. The man's arms were folded across his chest. He, like everyone else in the room, had been listening to the conversation. He let his arms drop by his side with one hand hovering near his pistol. When he did so, it revealed that he was wearing the star of a U.S. Marshal. Matt moved his own hand into position to draw. The tension in the room grew palpable, and everyone moved out of the way of what they were sure was an impending gunfight.
You are Marshal Kyle, aren't you? We met at the train wreck.
Yeah, we met there. But I believe you were telling people your name was Kavanaugh then.
My name is Kavanaugh.
No sense in lying about it now.
I know that you are Matt Jensen.
Yes, I am Matt Jensen, but Kavanaugh is the name I was born with.
Well now, this can be a little confusion.
Marshal, I didn't cause that train wreck. I didn't kill Deputy Hayes, and I didn't steal any money.
Odom killed the deputy.
You say Odom killed the deputy?
Yeah.
I suspected that. I appreciate the confirmation. Matt, you don't deny killing Deputy Gillis, do you?
I killed him.
Gillis drew first?
He tried to.
That's a good way of putting it. Now about you going to purgatory.
I'm going.
Oh, I'm sure you are going. I'm going with you.
Well, Marshal, I appreciate your interest, but I prefer to do this alone.
Oh, don't misunderstand me, Matt Jensen. I'm not asking for permission to come with you. On the contrary, I'm giving you permission to go with me.
You are giving me permission?
Well, let's say I'm asking you to come with me as a deputy U.S. Marshal.
Wait a minute. You're going to make me your deputy?
As a temporary thing, just until we get purgatory cleaned up.
But I don't understand. What about the other thing?
What other thing?
Then, suddenly, he smiled broadly and reached into his shirt pocket.
Oh, you must be talking about this.
Ben walked over to hand the paper to Matt.
What is this?
Read it. If you have any questions, I'll explain it. Though, how difficult is it to understand a full governor's pardon? Damn.
Yeah, I see them.
The two were looking at vultures, wings outstretched as they rode the thermal waves.
Coyote?
No, too many for a coyote. It's bigger than that.
Deer? Horse?
Look how they're staying away. If it was a deer or a horse, they'd be on it. No, whatever it is, they are afraid of it.
There's only one thing they're afraid of.
Yes.
Matt didn't have to say it aloud. He knew, and he knew that Kyle knew, that what the buzzards were circling was a man. It took at least half an hour before they reached the body. It was hanging from the branch of a cottonwood tree, twisting slowly at the end of the rope. Some of the vultures had gotten brave enough to descend to the upper branches of the tree, but none had actually reached the body yet, because it showed no signs of vulture feeding.
It's Dempster.
He was just a drunk. Who could a drunk make angry enough to do something like this?
He'd stop drinking. He's the biggest reason the governor granted you a pardon.
I'll be damned. He tried to defend me in the trial. I guess he never gave up.
My guess is that's what got him killed. He made an enemy of Cummins and his deputies.
You can't leave him just hanging like this.
You want to bury him?
No. I have a better idea.
Matt and Kyle arrived in purgatory at just about supper time, and along with the spicy aromas of Mexican cooking, they could smell coffee, pork chops, fried potatoes, and bacon bread. Matt was pulling a hastily constructed travois. Dempster's body was in plain sight, tied onto the travois. A game of checkers was being played by two gray-bearded men in front of the feed store, watched over by a half a dozen spectators. A couple of them looked up as Matt and Kyle rode by.
Son of a bitch! That's Dempster! That's Bob Dempster's body he's pulling!
Anion Goff came through the front door of his shop and began vigorously sweeping the wooden porch. His broom did little but raise the dust to swirl about, then fall back down again. Goff watched the two men ride by, then, nervously, went back into his shop and started pulling down window shades. Matt and Kyle stopped in front of the city mortuary, and Matt dismounted, then cut the travois loose. A tall, cadaverous-looking man, dressed all in black, stepped out of the building.
You the Undertaker?
Yes, sir. Proofrock is the name.
Take care of him, Proofrock.
Well, I would be glad to. Is the city going to pay for it?
Matt handed the Undertaker a $50 bill.
No, I'm paying for it. The city will be paying for the others.
What others?
Marshal Cummins and his deputies.
Wait. Proofrock, my name is Ben Kyle. I'm a United States Marshal. I'm going to ask you just one time, and if you know what is good for you, you'll tell me the truth. Have you ever heard of a man named Jerome? Cornelius Jerome?
Proofrock didn't answer.
You have 5 seconds to answer. Or when we finish with Cummins and his crowd, we will be coming back for you.
He's buried out here in Boot Hill, under the name Bill Smith.
If you knew his name, why did you bury him as Bill Smith?
It was what Marshal Cummins ordered. He killed him.
Cummins killed Jerome? Why?
He didn't mean to kill him. He was trying to shoot his hat off his head. It was an accident.
An accident?
Yes.
This is what I want you to do, Prufrock. I want you to write that out for me and sign it.
Oh, I can't do that. Cummins would...
Don't worry about Cummins. He'll be dead.
Leaving the startled Undertaker with Dempster's body, Matt and Kyle rode slowly down to the far end of the street and tied their horses off at the hitching post in front of the Perro Dice Saloon. When they dismounted, Kyle drew his pistol and pointed it into the air. A face appeared over the top of the Batwing doors, then looked out at Matt and Kyle.
Are you one of Cummins' deputies?
The man shook his head no.
Get the hell out of the saloon.
Without another word, without even looking back into the saloon, the man left and walked hurriedly on down the street.
Hear me. Anyone in the saloon who isn't with Marshal Cummins, come out there now.
A few seconds later, almost a dozen men came through the front door, then hastened to get out of the way. Though they didn't go so far as to not be able to see the show they were certain was about to take place. Kyle looked over at Matt.
Are you ready?
Matt didn't answer. Instead, he stepped up onto the porch, then pushed through the Batwing doors and went inside, backing up against the wall as he did so. At the bar, a glass of beer in front of him, his lips dripping with moisture, stood Cletus Odom. Also at the bar, but separated by the length of the bar from Odom, stood Marshal Cummins. Matt's lips twisted into an evil smile. Part of him wanted to kill both men this very instant, while part of him wanted to delay the pleasure. He could imagine the fear Dempster had shown when about to be hanged, and he wanted these two men to know that same terror.
Cummins, as a United States Marshal and acting upon the authority of Governor Fremont, I'm here to inform you that your office of City Marshal and the offices of all the deputies under you have been vacated. You no longer have any legal standing. In addition, I'm placing you all under arrest.
Now just what makes you think I'm gonna let you do that?
There's no letting to it, Cummins. We're doing it.
You and that murderer with you?
This man is a deputy U.S. Marshal.
A deputy U.S. Marshal, is he? And what the hell does that mean?
That means I can kill every damn one of you and it'll be legal.
I'm gonna ask all of you now to unbuckle your gun belts and let them drop to the floor.
Nah, thank you. I got no plans to hang.
You're gonna die at the end of a rope, or you're gonna die here today.
Cummins turned away from the bar and looked toward Odom. Odom and Cummins were at opposite ends of the bar. Jackson and Crack were also in the saloon, Jackson near the piano, Crack by the little pot-bellied stove. The four men were all spread out, which was going to make them more difficult targets than they would have been if they were closer together.
Could be that the two of you are the ones going to be doing the dying. You might have noticed there's four of us and only two of you.
Marshal, you take Cummins. I'll kill Odom.
Now!
Cummins, Odom, Crack, and Jackson all started for their guns. Matt reacted to the sudden move quickly. Drawing his own pistol faster than he'd ever drawn it before, he had his own gun out in time to take quick but deliberate aim and shoot Odom in the gut. Cummins had his gun out before Kyle, and his pistol shot cracked an instant after Matt's. The bullet from Cummins' pistol hit Kyle in the left shoulder, even as Kyle was pulling the trigger on his own gun. Kyle's bullet hit Cummins in the chest. Even as Odom's gun was clattering to the floor and he was putting his hands over his belly wound, watching the blood spill through his fingers, Matt was turning his attention to Jackson and Crack. But because they were some distance apart, he had to be very deliberate in selecting his target, so he went after Jackson first. Knowing that Crack was behind him and had not fired yet, Matt threw himself down just as Crack did fire. Firing up from the floor, Matt's bullet hit Crack under the chin. Getting up from the floor, but still holding on to his smoking gun, Matt looked over at Marshal Kyle. Kyle was leaning against the bar, holding his hand over the bleeding wound.
How bad is it?
Oh, it hurts like a son of a bitch, but I'll live.
Matt walked over to look down at Odom.
You know why I shot you in the gut instead of the head?
Because you couldn't hit me in the head?
Oh, I could have, but I wanted you to die real slow.
Why? Why did you take such a personal interest in killing me?
Even if I told you, you wouldn't understand.
Both Matt and Kyle whirled toward the Batwing doors, their pistols raised and ready.
Hold it, don't shoot!
The man had both hands up to show that he wasn't armed.
It's all right, Jensen, I know him. Goodman, what are you doing here?
We came to check up on you, Marshal.
Well, you better get out of here before the rest of Cummins' deputies get here.
You don't have to be worrying none about them, Marshal.
What do you mean?
I mean, Duke, Warren, and Gates are in jail. Soon as the folks coming out of the saloon told us what was going on, we figured them boys would probably be going down there to help out Cummins. So we just waited for them and got the drop on them.
You got a doctor in this town?
Yeah, we do.
Well, quit standing here palavering. Go get the doctor for the Marshal.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that.
Turning, he walked to the Batwing doors.
Get Dr. Urban up here to tend to the Marshal!
Matt waited until Dr. Urban arrived, then stood by as the doctor examined the wound.
How bad is it, Doc?
Well, it's not bad at all. It looks like the bullet just left a little crease. If it doesn't putrefy, it should heal up quickly.
It's good to know.
Matt took the badge off his shirt and handed it to the Marshal.
You are welcome to keep that deputy badge. I can always use a good man like you. The law can always use a good man like you.
I appreciate it, Marshal, but I think I'll just be getting on.
Where are you headed?
You know, I haven't really given that any thought.
Hey, what about me?
What about you?
Ain't she gonna let the doctor look at me?
Wouldn't do any good for the doctor to see you. You're gonna die no matter what he does.
Yeah, but you can't just leave me here to die on the floor.
As Matt headed to the door, he thought of Susie Dobbs and all the others killed and injured in the train wreck caused by this man.
You can't leave me like this!
Yeah, I can't.
You son of a bitch! I'll see you in hell!
Not likely. I've done my time in purgatory.
Jensen Number 3, Purgatory, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2008, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Tony Penny, David Coyne, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Michael Glenn, Michael John Casey, Christopher Graybill, Andy Clemens, Dylan Lynch, James Konacek, Ren Casey, Karen Novak, Kimberly Gilbert, Yasmin Twazon, Drew Kopis, Scott McCormick, Christopher Sheeran, Eric Messner, Johan Detweiler, and Ken Jackson. Directed and adapted by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. Additional music by Johan Detweiler and Brian Patton. The Matt Jensen theme was composed and performed by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed Matt Jensen Number 3, Purgatory, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com and be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles, and Sidewinder series, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Ranger series, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
Tell me, Kip. If you've done bad things your whole life, but you die doing something good, do you think that makes up for all the bad?
No.
Me neither.
But it's better than nothing. Orcholum is merciful.
Wonder if you'll say that after they're done with your village.
Gavin Guile is the Prism, the most powerful man in the world. He is High Priest and Emperor, a man whose power, wit, and charm are all that preserves a tenuous peace. A peace that is slowly rotting from the inside out.
This is all that's left of what was once a great civilization. Statues of great men, broken by the pygmies who followed. Let me tell you something you already know. Something that all of you have believed, but no one dared to say. The wrong Guile won the Prism's war. They killed him because they were worried he would change everything. They feared him because Dazen Guile wanted to free us. Dazen knew that light cannot be chained.
As darkness slowly encroaches upon the land, Gavin receives a mysterious letter.
I'm dying, Gavin. It's time you meet your son, Kip. Lena.
As Gavin races to find his son, he learns of a new and dangerous threat to his empire. A man who calls himself King.
Your time is finished. Yours and the Chromarians. You're done! Light cannot be chained. Know this, Prism. We will take back what you've stolen. The horrors of your reign are almost at an end. And when it ends, I will be there. This, I swear!
With the death of his empire looming, Gavin will be forced to wage a war on multiple fronts. But little does he know, his assassin may be looking right before his very eyes.
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him, you hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him.
Yes, Mother?
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip.
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Don't miss the beginning of the end in Brent Week's critically acclaimed new series, The Lightbringer Trilogy. Book 1, The Black Prism, Parts 1 through 3. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.